Okay, good morning and welcome to Critical Resistance Stoner Call / Webinar on Bail, Bond, and Abolition. My name is Jess. I'm the Development Director at Critical Resistance and one of the many people who so appreciates our grassroots donor support that helps us keep the door open and building with incredible organizers all across the country as we fight to dismantle the systems of policing, imprisonment, surveillance, courts, bail, and bond, including that explicitly today. So this call is being recorded. It will be posted to our website later today, and it can be a public resource for folks to share. Should you want to refer to this later and bring it back to your organizations or the communities that you work with. And so now I'm going to pass it off to our facilitator and host for the hour, Lily Fossey Haskell, who is our campaigns director here at CR and has been working with our membership in the Los Angeles chapter and Oakland chapters fighting against jail construction in California. We have two coalitions that we're an anchor organization in, the Los Angeles No More Jails Coalition and No New San Francisco Jail. So without further ado, passing it off to Lily, who can speak about some of that work and bring our speakers up to the mic for today.
Well, thanks, Jess. Yeah, I'm really excited to be here in this conversation. Again, my name is Lily. I work as the campaign director here at Critical Resistance, the national organization. But as Jess mentioned, involved with local campaigns in various chapter cities. And so a number of our campaigns are related to jail closures or stopping jail expansion. And with that, that is a large impetus or force that connects us to the bail reform work and the thinking that we're doing around bail reform and the relationships that we're trying to build with organizations such as Southerners on New Ground in Atlanta. Really excited to have Mary here. And Chicago Community Bond Fund in Chicago. And grateful for Charlene for joining us as well. These are two cities that we don't have chapters in, but we have done a little bit of work in connecting over the past couple of years and also have various histories of organizing and doing political work in those cities. So part of CR's work is doing the campaigns out of our chapters, but then also really trying to build and support this national movement with forces that we believe are politically aligned and are walking the same road with us. So thank you for joining this morning and also being on that long road with us too. So just to set the stage a little bit for our conversation, as everyone knows, we're in this heated pitched moment of bail reform coming up as a national agenda and also being practiced on local levels. And it's exciting to see this strong movement in three different arenas. So one, the being the legislative and legal reforms to the system, legal challenges in various municipalities, as well as state and local legislative work. The grassroots engagement, organizing, and education that's happening, and I think that the Mama's Day bailout and the other subsequent bailouts have been a huge example of that work of really uplifting the moment for bail reform. And then I would just say also the connection that's happening between working towards bail reform and then the individual support and self-help models to get people out of jails. So excited to talk about those three realms and others for how we connect bail reform to a broader abolitionist movement. CR does not have active campaigns around bail reform per se right now, but we have been engaged in bail reform as connected to our anti-imprisonment work on a California state level, as well as looking at how bail reform would impact the jail population numbers in San Francisco as connected to the work that we're doing, fighting ongoing proposals for jail expansion in San Francisco and trying to reduce the jail population. So really our engagement has been looking at this history of practical abolitionist reforms that we've been moving through campaigns and organizing work, a lot of them in coalitions with other amazing organizations and broad-based organizations, and looking at those campaigns and how we can really engage these practical reforms towards an abolitionist vision, and thinking about what are some of the possibilities for the prison industrial complex to shift and reform. And unfortunately, engage other ways of caging and controlling people, and that are not based in the cash bail system or other ways of state control that are not rooted in the physical cages, right? Be that electronic monitoring, be that other fines and fees outside of cash bail, other types of supervised release programs, et cetera. So really looking at the long-term vision for abolition and how we can get to that through this, what I see as like small, but also a huge reform around bail. So some of that thinking has been in conversations that we've been having with different organizations. Some of it has been in doing some analysis around public safety assessment tools that would be used to determine who would be eligible for release. And then some of it is based on sort of looking at historical campaigns. And so we've offered a resource for today that's sort of key questions or principles, points that we want to think through and engage with. It's part of a working document that CR has been using to just engage our brains a little bit around this issue. So I offer a few of the points from that document that we're thinking about. So the first being that with bail reform, we need to be super aware of not leaving behind those who are criminalized with the most serious charges, especially in particular because we know that charges may increase when bail reform gets passed through. So DAs may overcharge, cops may overcharge. And so we want to make sure, or in even more than they do already, right? So we want to make sure that we don't leave anyone behind, and we try to make as expansive bail reforms as possible. We also know that particular people are oftentimes those who receive the highest level charges. So that being, I think, especially Black people, other people of color, and poor working people. So our work for bail reform must inherently and intimately be tied with our work to actually close down jails so that we don't get certain people out and then those cages are filled with others, right? We need to look at a radical rethinking of how we resource our communities and make investments in our communities, and also understand and look towards how we can decriminalize. So seeing not just not framing things as, you know, the root of the problem is the lack of alternatives, but also the root of the problem is the policing that is impacting our communities, right? And that it comes from a long history of the oppression of people of color in this country and internationally. Through this work, we also need to look at whole families and whole communities and all of the various ways that people are impacted by the prison industrial complex. We need to work for solutions that are non-punitive and non-compulsory so that people can voluntarily participate in. And then we need to look to how we can also implement practical as well as political framing around dismantling and defunding the police alongside this. And I would add too how we look towards not investing more resources in the courts and the DAs, because I think that some of the reforms that are being looked at also put more money into court procedures, more money into prosecution. So trying to uplift that as well. So with that long introduction, I want to jump right into it. I'm going to kick it off to Mary first to share. We'll have a little bit of sharing about each of the organizations, and then we will go into some questions, and then we'll have time for a Q&A at the end from audience members. So Mary, if you could just share a little bit about what Southerners on New Ground does, where you're based, who you work with, and what's been your engagement around this topic of bail reform, would be great.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for having me. Send greetings all the way from the South. My name is Mary Hope, and I use she and her pronouns, and I work with, I'm the co-director of Song Southerners on New Ground. We're a 24-year-old scrappy Southern grassroots organizing shop and a political home for LGBTQ people that are living, loving, thriving, and fighting for everybody's safety and dignity. And we envision a South that is free from fear for all of our people across communities. And so we have been engaging in this conversation around bail reform. I believe we started having this conversation last year. And I think over the last, maybe the last 5 years or so, give or take, this is back when Kaya Lumumba Barrow, who is one of the founders of Critical Resistance, was on staff. And we began building out our campaign arm, essentially thinking about what do we do with this kinship network that Song has built over time of connecting LGBTQ people across the South to break isolation and to come together to be able to make material changes in our communities by taking on campaigns and doing culture change work. And so there, over the last few years, we've learned so much about what it means to do campaign work, and specifically drilling in areas where, as we say, the bleeding points of our communities, right? Where we see the caging of our people happening, where police and state violence is happening, where are the bleeding points in our communities? And then how do we organize ourselves around those issues to be able to make impacts and changes? And, you know, given the South is a red state, and I'm sure many of you on this call, if live in a red state now, we understand that policy changes isn't something that comes easy, and it's not something that happens all the time. And so as we've been developing these campaigns, we've just been finding different entry points and opportunities to put more pressure, to actually, you know, see where we can make changes at. And I think as we begin, but specifically here in Atlanta, and let me back up a little bit, we do work in, we have folks moving work in Atlanta, Georgia, Durham, North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, Asheville, North Carolina. We're doing a lot of stuff in North Carolina.
We need it in North Carolina.
Yes, Charlottesville, North Carolina, Kingston, North Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, Harrisonburg, Virginia, and we have members across the South who engage in song work through regional convenings and trainings, providing, working on different projects that also help serve, you know, the work that's moving across the region. But in Atlanta, we begin our campaign work by exploring the demand around trying to get fines and fees that folks are being allocated through the court based on their income, which is, most folks use the term day fines. I believe it's in Finland, maybe New Zealand, one of the places there where that's actually a thing. And we started doing that work, and we just, you know, based on our own experiences as folks who live in this community, who just have lived experience around police and what it means, and what many of our members were like, yo, we've been having to bail people out. Like, just, you know, we're living these lives. We're not advocates. We're directly impacted. And so when we begin grappling with this issue around cash bail, we begin thinking that this may be an entry point to in getting fines and fees based on income, right? We're like, which one comes first, the chicken or the egg? Which one is which in this situation? And given the nature of the cash bail system and seeing how it's playing out in so many communities that our members are a part of, we're, when we met with our members at the beginning of the year, we made a commitment to try to end cash bail across the South where we're moving work. And the Mama's Day bailout was one of the ways, and it was actually before we even like solidify that that was the move we were going to make across the region, it was a vision. And once I shared it out with the Song family, everyone was like, of course, yes, this makes sense. Like, yes, of course we should be doing this. And I think a lot of it also was inspired and was thinking about how over the last few years we've seen so many of our folks take a rest in rapid response and protest moments, and thinking about, yo, we actually could be using that money to be bailing folk out who got to get back home to their babies, you know, who didn't expect for the state to interrupt their lives, and now they're sitting in a cage and are losing so much. And so, yeah, I could talk more a little bit later about Mama's Day bailout and specifically around some of the lessons we learned, but I do think it was an opportunity for us to continue to highlight the crisis in the communities that we have folks doing work, because so many people, even though there's been years of amazing work that has been happening toward ending cash bail, so many people didn't realize that this was something that was unconstitutional, that it's something that can be changed, that there is, you know, some progressive winds and that is happening around it and movement is happening around it. So being able to highlight the crisis has been essential to the work and the fights that we're trying to take on here in the South. And yeah, I'll stop there. And I'm sure we'll get more into that as we go on.
The juiciness of all of the work that's happening. Cool. Thank you for kicking us off, Mary. Charlene, would you say a little bit about Chicago Community Bond Fund, what your organization does, and also specific to bail, what you've been working on?
I was on mute.
There you go.
Okay. Thanks. So Chicago Community Bond Fund is a volunteer-run project. We're based in Chicago. We got our start in August of 2014 when the Chicago police killed a 17-year-old young black man on the south side of Chicago named Deshaun Pittman. And a couple days after he was killed, his family and his friends organized a candlelight vigil, and the police came and disrupted that vigil. Really, they attacked it, and they arrested 8 people, and they charged 5 of them with serious felonies, including Deshaun's mother. And the total bond needed to get 5 of those people out of the jail was almost $30,000. And so a group of us who are already active, mostly around policing, anti-policing work, and anti-criminalization work, met up with the family members of the people who were in the jail on these bonds, recruited other folks, and basically started a grassroots fundraising effort to get people out. So first we raised money. It was crowdsourcing, it was fish fries and raffles and all sorts of things. We were able to get Deshaun's mother out within a few days so that she could attend his funeral. And then we kept fundraising for everyone else. But it took us 4 months to get the 5th person out. So from August to December of 2014, it was sort of this constant fundraising struggle and different online campaigns and parties around the city and things like that. And many, many people, well, you know, hundreds of people ultimately who donated and helped raise that. And then we finally got the last young man out in December of that year. At the end of that, his mother, really, Jeanette Wentz is her name. She's one of the Bond Fund's co-founders. She said, you know, this is amazing that we got him out. I believe his bond, I can't remember now if it was $8,000 or $10,000 that we had to post, but it was a lot. He was in his early 20s. Obviously, by then, he'd lost his job that he had when he went in, just profoundly disrupted his life, and then and changed it forever, being in Cook County Jail that long. Like, this is amazing that we raised all this money. Still, my baby was in jail for 4 months. So what if, like, how do we... create a structure where this doesn't take 4 months next time. And that's really the sort of where the idea for starting a revolving bond fund came in Chicago. And people had talked about it for a while in different circles too, especially people who supported direct actions or protests, people who might be arrested on the streets and need money to get out, and how to sort of lessen the risk of taking political action in the streets also. So we had our first organizing meeting in December of 2014, a few weeks after Derek was bailed out. And then we really got going in the summer of 2015. And no, is that right? Now I messed up my timeline, but 2015. And we posted our first bond in December of 2015. So we really set up as our mission two things. One, to get people out now. So to post bond for folks who are in the jail and are there only because they don't have the money to get out. And then two, to advocate for the end of money bond, just the same thing as money bail here. It's just called bond in Illinois. And so to advocate for the end of money bail and pretrial incarceration. So to that end, since December of 2014 or 2015 to now, we've bonded out 77 people from Cook County Jail. We posted more than $400,000. All of that money essentially comes from individual donors. We don't have any restrictions on the money that we use to post bond. We don't have any restrictions on the types of charges that we post bond for. We do identify explicitly as an abolitionist organization. So we are not guilt or innocence based. We don't distinguish between misdemeanors or felonies or violent or nonviolent charges. In fact, almost everyone in Cook County Jail is charged with a felony. So fewer than 6% of the people in our jail are there on misdemeanors. And we've actually posted bond for at least three people that have murder charges, including some Black women who are charged with crimes related to self-defense. And we've worked with local groups that are part of the Survived and Punished Network to identify and support those folks in their cases after we've posted bond. And we really try to use as much as people want and willing. It's obviously all voluntary. If people want to tell their stories when they get out, then we want to help lift up those personal narratives and change the public conversation around who's in the jail and why, and what the impact of being in the jail is, so that the individual work of supporting folks and getting them free now is also complementing the larger system change work. Because there are about 7,400 people in Cook County Jail, and the majority of them have money bonds that they can't pay. So more than 4,000 people with bond they can't pay. So we're really proud and happy about the 77 people that we've been able to get out, but it's obviously a tiny drop in the bucket. And so just being able to use a bond fund to get people out is not our ultimate goal. We need to change that system. And in all of our messaging, we've targeted money bond because it is a primary driver of pretrial incarceration in Cook County and across the country. But all of our messaging will say abolish money bail or abolish money bond and end pretrial detention, because we recognize that our target is really ending pretrial incarceration, and that if we got rid of money bond and there were the same number of people in Cook County Jail after that, and then they had no way out, as opposed to at least the option of being bailed out, that obviously wouldn't be a win. And we start with money bond as an entry point because people understand on its face how unfair it is, that access to money is the problem. And then when we start talking about the harms, the separation from family and community that Mary was talking about, the lost jobs, the lost housing, even lost custody of kids, those are harms that come from pretrial incarceration, not money bond, right? Money bond is just the mechanism. So we've been trying to use money bond as an entry point to really talk about the harms of pretrial incarceration. And then of course, many of those are the same harms as any kind of incarceration. Let me think about what we do. We have been part of some more systemic change efforts here. We're part of a coalition working to end money bond, and there was legislation put forward as part of the coalition that we consulted on and have been supportive of. We sort of always took the position of we're supportive until negotiations start going, and then we need to be that out, you know, then we're totally going to be that outside game if we need to be, that's like, this can't like we can't support anything that's going to further increase the power of the state to incarcerate people pre-trial. We're lucky in Illinois because, like many states, we do have a constitutional right to bail, a right to pretrial freedom. And so there are limits on what the legislature can do when they start, at least in Illinois, I think this is the case with a lot of legislatures. If we get something like bail reform, then they tie it up with something else that's going to increase the penalties for someone else. And obviously, we don't want to leave anyone behind. I think, Lily, you framed all of that much better than I could. And we also, we have been able to impact the language in that coalition, the messaging, the press conferences, and the way that bail reform is being talked about. So for example, we try to always say pretrial incarceration and not pretrial detention, right? Detention's a euphemism for incarceration. And we also are actively engaging the conversation around public safety, but in a way that doesn't allow people to oversimplify it and equate it to locking people up, right? So we talk about the long-term impact of destabilizing people and their lives and then entire communities, because Cook County Jail is a profoundly anti-Black space, as most of these lockups are. Cook County is only 25% Black, but Cook County Jail is 73% Black. So other than a very small Native American population, Black folks are actually the only group of people that are overrepresented in the jail, the only racial or ethnic group overrepresented in the jail in Chicago. So it's really directly impacting one specific community. And we always try to talk about that and emphasize the racial justice and economic justice aspects of bail reform. And I think that might be all I need to do in the overview. So,
cool. Thank you very much. Yeah, and that's, I mean, that those numbers are, on the one hand, I mean, it's obvious, they're always astounding, and then also heartbreakingly clear and obvious, and the case all over the country, you know, in San Francisco, where we were fighting the jail, the Black population in San Francisco now is 3% by some estimates, and 56% of the jail. And that number has not changed over the years, where the number of the population in San Francisco has been in rapid decline. Overall of Black people, the number of the percentage of Black people in the jail has remained consistent. So we see this as a targeted attack. And I think that that's part of why we have to engage these questions around how bail reform and how closing jails and how any of the abolitionist efforts that we take on can really address the root of the problem, right? The root of oppressing and targeting and controlling populations by the state, and in particular specific populations, as an effort to enforce social control and the rules and laws of the state and the economy of the state, right? And I think, like, when you talk about safety, Charlene, and we'd love to hear from Mary next, but I think when we talk about safety, that's part of why we also have to talk about this. And I think it's easier in this moment, right? It's becoming more uplifted in this moment, but we have to talk about the lack of safety for people in their communities because of policing, because of imprisonment, right? And that is A and B direct cause of a lot of the problems that we see around public safety, right? And we can't have a simple, like, rubric of questions for engaging public safety that many of these reforms want to put in place with the public safety assessments to determine whether or not someone can be released and quote unquote back into their communities. So Mary, I would love to hear a little bit more about digging into some of the work that you're doing, but also just some of your thinking, because I think that you've really been on the fore of this with the Movement for Black Lives, with Song, with the Mama's Day bailout. Of what opportunities do you see on local and national levels for bail reform? But not just what opportunities do you see in terms of the practical applications of bail reform, but what's your take on the growth of this national movement and what are the opportunities around growing this movement for bail reform? And then what does that mean for engaging more and more people and more broad movements in an abolitionist vision and an abolitionist praxis as we're moving forward? What is the opportunity here for really bringing more and more people into this movement to abolish the prison industrial complex?
Cool beans. Well, I think that one of the things that's been on my peanut is this thought around what we can move locally and then what we know is moving nationally, right? And there's supposed to be some federal legislation that's going to be drafted in order to incentivize some states to end the practice of cash bail and be able to give folks different grants or what have you to be able to change their systems up. And I think that there are some things that, we're a little leery about given, that obviously they're not thinking about an abolitionist frame. There's some flags around risk assessment. There's some flags around is corrections getting more money? Is courts getting more money? How much is even going to private companies, right? And so all of those sorts of things. But I think the true opportunity comes on a local level where I think we're able to experiment and try and actually push local power holders to really think about and even change the frame up, particularly around risk assessment. And we're asking the wrong question, right? It's not, is this person a risk? The question is this person who, again, who have not been tried nor convicted, told their story, innocent to proven guilty, what do they need to come back to court?
Yes.
We change the frame around needs assessment. We actually can begin kind of going and unearthing some of the root causes, right? Some of the root causes of the war on drugs and the impacts of the war on drugs, right? I feel like the conversation and what we're seeing right now play out, even after the Mama's Day bailout, and we knew that many of the folks that we bailed out, had been cycled into jail, several times, right? And it's not because, and oftentimes, here in Atlanta, they have a standard pretty much. They're like, oh, if you're homeless, we're not going to give you a bond because you don't have an address. And if we don't have an address, then we can't give you notification that you can come to court. So most people just sit, right? But we actually need to be, the needs assessment will actually be able to say, hey, y'all, we're actually not making the investments because if people are saying that they need housing, that if people are saying they need childcare, transportation, then that light bulb would come off and say, okay, then perhaps we need to stop investing our money in police, jails, courts, and all this sort of mess, mm-hmm. and divest from those things and invest in, the lives of our people, right? In affordable housing, in jobs programs and all these things in which many people that we bailed out had already lost because they were sitting there. And it wasn't the first time that they'd had lost because they were sitting in the cage pre-trial incarceration. And so I think that there's many opportunities to really push some progressive changes around bail reform. And I think that, the Mama's Day bailout, and again, this work has been happening for years. And I think that we're newbies in the game, real talk, because there are folks who've been doing some really great mm-hmm. work, have given language to this, have been able to help break down like what all this has meant for our communities, all the things. I think the Mama's Day bailout, it kind of pulled on the heartstrings of people. I think it also tapped into the hearts and mind shift, right? When we start begging the question of why we were bailing out mothers who literally a woman called the police for them to check the VIN on the car she just bought. And they come back to her and say, oh, we're about to arrest you for a 3-year-old warrant for a ticket regarding your not wearing your safety belt. And she's sitting up in a cage for 5 days with 6 children at home. Unacceptable, right? Wow. I mean, no one should have to sit in a cage. When we hear the heinousness, particularly, you know, with local and county jails and for Atlanta, that's where a lot of folks who have misdemeanors are. And all traffic offenses in Georgia are considered misdemeanors. So everything is a jailable offense, you know? And so in any case, I feel like I'm rambling, but I feel like the opportunities on the federal level, we have to be careful about what's being proposed as like the model, you know, risk assessment as the model. And I think that we actually really need to be thinking about how we're building statewide power to be able to build this, bring this fight to scale on the statewide level and really look at fights that are happening in California and the different coalition and alliances that are being brought together in order to make this a statewide conversation, particularly in red states. I think else we do that, we'll see, you know, the tricks that these right-wing red states play, right? They push down the preemption where local fights and local wins will get pretty much smacked down, and they'll say, oh, you can't pass this particular thing anymore on a local level. And that's how we saw the fight with HB2 in North Carolina around the quote-unquote bathroom bills. That was in direct response to local organizing and a local organizing win that took place in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as them also passing a $15 wage for city workers, right? And that also was part of the preemption. So we have to really think about what can we do on a local and statewide level, and just given who the administration is and the powers that be, I don't know what opportunities we're going to see manifesting on a federal level that actually is going to be a reflection of the sort of policy that we know is going to actually change and shift the conditions of our people, and especially address the racial disparities. But I think also the act of bailing out the folks being able to contribute their resources to buy someone else's freedom, I think is what has ignited this particular tactic in action that folks engaged in. Real talk, when we started, you know, we said it to our homies at the Movement for Black Lives policy table, like, hey, we're going to do this action. What do you think? And folks are like, oh my gosh, yes, this is the right thing to do. And folks got immediately excited about it and became a national action. And I think because we are in a political moment where people are yearning for something to do, people are yearning to be able to be a part of social change right now, people are yearning to, like, you know, do something in defiance of Trump. People just want to turn up because it's a Tuesday and Trump is still in office, and people are like, I want to be on the right side of this thing and not be the one who has to tell our grandchildren that when all of this mayhem was happening, that we sat silently and watched it play out on the media. And so an action like the Mama's Day bailout, the Father's Day bailouts, bailouts that folks did around Pride, the random bailouts that we've just been doing because it's a Tuesday and somebody has called with a need. We actually just bailed out somebody yesterday, or Monday, kudos to that, is giving our people an opportunity to contribute to someone else's freedom, but it's also providing our people with the political education around this issue. Again, many people did not know that this is something that could be changed, you know, especially for those who have more wealth than others. Their process and what is, if they've ever experienced it, having, you know, to get arrested, they usually are getting out. There's no thought about it. It, you know, don't even realize the whole bond situation. And I mean, it's a little jarring, especially for someone who, this is my lived experience all the time. And I'm like, you don't know this is happening. So people, I think, are getting put up on game on what's actually happening. And so there's an opportunity for more people to participate in changing this policy and changing this practice, rather it's happening where they're located, but then because the opportunities to give are happening on a national scale, what have you, folks can continue to contribute. And the work that we've done inside of the Movement for Black Lives Policy, one of the things that we were able to do at the beginning of the year, we put out a toolkit, a bail reform toolkit, that many of our folks across the region have been holding, you know, kitchen table conversations, small group meetings, et cetera, for folks to be able to learn and understand how are we connecting the police murders that we're seeing to bail reform, right? To seeing, you know, and we talk about Sandra Bland and that toolkit around like, actually, let's walk out what could, what should have happened if bail reform was in place, and what, but what actually did happen, and why did she sit in a cage for $500 and her life was at stake, and she, you know, eventually was murdered, right? And so we also address Khalif Browder, right, and the impacts of the bail system, and not just and what it has on our material losses, but our peace of mind. People are literally losing their minds in a cage. We have to hold that. And so putting out this popular political education tool has really been helpful. People have been accessing it. People have been using it because one of the things, again, if people don't know that this is happening and understand the root causes of the issue and to bring a historical analysis around it, then people won't get involved. So with the action, political education, and all the bail reform work that's happening, the time is right. The time is right.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. And I think in particular, like you're talking about, people don't want to be left behind from this movement. I think that that also makes me think of and brings us back to some of the roots of like why we also call this movement abolition, right? And that we need to be pushing for a revisioning and a complete overhaul of the systems that we're working within right now, and returning to the fight and looking back at the fight against slavery in this country, and hopefully now we're in a place where actually more and more people will take action too. That's great. Thank you, Mary. So Charlene, I wanted to see if you could talk a little bit. You touched on this a little bit, but building off of what Mary was engaging around that grassroots movement, if you could talk a little bit more about your work locally to get people free from the jails. I think the relationship to the work that Mary was talking about with the Mama's Day bailout and the other bailouts is clear. And then also, like, what are some lessons you've learned around bailing people out in Chicago that you think could inform how we shape bail reform, whether on a local or national level? So for instance, just a quick note, one of the things that we're considering in San Francisco, because the city is actually considering whether or not to move to a city fund for bail reform. And one of the things that we've been pushing back, I see the head shaking. So we've been pushing back on a number of levels, but one of the aspects of pushing back is actually based out of lessons learned from the bailout actions and lessons learned from people's lives and lived experience and why we're fighting bail reform in San Francisco. We have some of the highest bail in the country. And so we're looking at minimum bail amounts of 10,000 upwards for routine charges. We're looking at $50,000. So where would we even begin to start with creating our own bail fund to begin with? But also, you know, of course, we don't want to put more resources into re-entrenching that system is the main root of that problem, right? We want to overhaul it. We want to get rid of it. We want to address the root cause. What have you learned through that? And Mary, after Charlene, if you want to add in anything else that jumps to your mind, please do jump in. But what have you learned from that work of bailing people out for how we could move and impact actual bail reform?
Sure. I'm unmuted, right? Okay. The first thing I want to say, because I don't know if I said it fully in the beginning, is that we really see the work of bail reform and explicitly abolitionist bail reform in Chicago as part of a Black Lives Matter and movements for Black liberation as much as possible, try to align ourselves with the goals of other organizers in Chicago and especially Black-led groups in Chicago. And we do continue to bail out people who created this national momentum, who created this moment that, you know, advocates and funders and everyone else is taking advantage of, and grassroots groups, we're taking advantage of it too, but people in the streets who created this moment and are so about 14 of the people that we've posted bond for out of the 77 were people arrested at actions, and those were primarily Black Lives Matter related actions. And then we've also done things like partner with Black Lives Matter Chicago to post bond for people who are arrested at the scene of police shootings, people who are arrested because of their response when they saw their family members murdered by police in front of them. So really trying to make sure that when we talk about bail, we talk about it as one part of this larger, you know, as part of the prison industrial complex, we usually talk about larger systems of punishment, incarceration, criminalization. And so really having that conversation, and part of what we have learned in bailing people out too is that I think Mary gave that example of the state not releasing people who don't have housing. We have the problem of, even if we want to post bond for folks with who don't have stable housing, we're trying to post bond to free people, but because we criminalize homelessness, that person is going to be arrested again for trespassing, and they're going to be right back in the jail. So we'll have put up some amount of money, but we won't have succeeded in keeping them free. And that's how we see the limits of the conversation. We're only talking around bail because we have to talk about our responses to homelessness or to substance use or addiction, and all the other things that right now our response is criminalization. So we see those limits, the limits of only talking about bail reform in our work of posting bond, certainly. And then I think, you know, this is a hard lesson. I'm going to admit it, even though it's recorded. It's also tempting sometimes to overestimate our ability to influence the public conversation. So we are having this robust conversation around bail reform as increasing public safety because we're no longer locking people up, and because locking people up makes us all less safe. The people who are in cages, as Mary said, and then also all of us who want people to succeed, right? Because we're taking people away from the things they need that succeed, their jobs, their homes, their family, and their support networks. And we have a large number of people, a growing number of people who hear that message and engage with it. But then when it comes time for a conversation about bail reform legislation, the people who are called by the major newspapers that are read by the largest number of people are the sheriff and the prosecutors and the chief of police. And I think that that's been challenging for us because we're like, we have this great message and we have a lot of people engaging with it. But then ultimately we have to remember that there are these huge other forces, and they're going to use the platform of bail reform to fearmonger around money bond in a way that's really fearmongering around releasing people pretrial, right? Saying money bail is bad and we need bail reform because it lets violent people out and we need the power to lock more people up, so they shouldn't be allowed to have bail, right? So those combating that has been something that we've had to really take on aggressively and even try to get respond to it, but also try to get in the forefront of it. And that's something we've also used stories to do. So when the sheriff or someone else is talking publicly about these people are posting bond, you know, they'll talk about people who are in gangs, gang members are bonding each other out, and then they're committing new crimes, and we're, you know, money bail is bad. We'll say, we've posted bond for dozens of people with quote unquote violent charges, all of whom are free and succeeding and thriving, surviving, and they're out, and talk about, push back against a narrative that only tries to identify negative stories and tries to make broad generalizations and say, our experience is different, and it's right here, and here are the numbers, and here are the people. And we also, we also try to make sure that we have folks speaking about their experience in the jail who don't have the most accessible or sympathetic charges. So we'll have people who were accused of violent crimes and were in the jail talking about what it was like to be separated from their children. And then when that conversation comes up, there's a different face, because we're not only talking about theft and traffic, and I think those are important conversations to have too, because it shows the wantonness of and how easily we use this, but we do try to make sure that we have folks who are more representative of who's in the jail and also help us humanize the people with the charges that sound scarier, and make sure that those are folks who are being able to tell their stories and are, the public is identifying with them, with or without knowing those charges. And then that sort of disrupts the other link that's being created by different forces. So I hope those were useful lessons.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Yeah, it's so important to do both of those reframes, right? One, what are we talking about with people impacted, and how are we talking about all people needing to get free, in particular those most criminalized? And then also, how do we do the reframe that shifts to the root of the problem, and the onus being not on the people who are getting out and getting back to their communities, but the onus being on the police and the sheriffs and imprisonment on the one hand, and then also like that this is about all of us, right? And I really appreciated, Mary, your framing around needs assessment, because I think that when risk assessment is used, then automatically in that language, a number of things happen like that you pointed to. But one of the other things is that that it really picks out that individual, right? Instead of being about what is the need for the whole community, right? It does this thing of splitting out an us and them when we know that we are a we and we are an us, right? And so does this work that we're trying to dislodge of who are the threats to society and who are the society that we want to protect, right? And we know that we have to unseat that and challenge that in all of our work. So thank you both for that. I want to open up to our participants to see if there's any other questions. And then also, if you have questions or thoughts for each other, now's the time. Hopefully we can unmute and we'll just kick it off. Let's see. All right, is there anyone from the audience who would like to offer a question or thought that is coming to the top of your mind from hearing from Mary and Charlene?
On a technical note, everyone is now unmuted unless you have muted yourself. So you are welcome to speak up and thoughts, feedback, questions, most encouraged.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, hi.
Please say your name, that would be great, thank you.
My name's Eric, and I live in Florida work at CIU, which is a labor union across the country, but down here we have been working for a number of years at building a community union, together with a number of partners, including Dream Defenders, who participated in the money bail, Mama's Day bailouts, and Father's Day bailouts down here in Florida over the last few weeks. Mary, just being from a southern state, I'm very inspired by the work that you all are doing and have done in leading this around the country and around the South. And also just thankful about hearing these. I think that we have been trying to, as a union, think about how we engage more deeply around movements around prison abolition and broader criminal justice work, and I think that we've been doing around economic justice the criminal state. Obviously, Florida is an awful place for communities that our members are in and that we've been organizing deeply in with a lot of partners around the state for a long time. And so I'm just very inspired, Mary, to hear about some of the victories and some of the ways that in other cities that in the South that you've been helping them work connect movements. And, you all were talking, I didn't know about the toolkits and stuff. So, we have a number of people who are trying to research, in the state and work together around, kind of creating a real strategy around bail reform and then more broadly around, dealing with the terrible criminal justice realities in our state. So very thankful for all the learnings that you all shared today and, hopeful to maybe connect in the future around this.
Awesome, Eric. Thank you so much, yo. You can check out nomoremoneybail.org, nomoremoneybail.org, and that's the national website for the National Bailout Coalition, and there's that toolkit is on there. So totally check it out. And we're also drafting a toolkit for folks who want to do bailout and, you know, help folks plan and prepare and think about how they want to do that. And yeah, so cool that you're jamming out with the homies down at Dream Defenders. Awesome comments. Very cool.
Awesome.
Hi, this is Miriam calling. Miriam Kappa, sorry. Hi, everybody. I'm really glad to hear from both of you about all the work that's been getting done. I'm excited about it. I was wondering, Charlene, can you speak a little bit to the challenges of doing this work as a volunteer group of folks versus, having actual staff to do the work? Maybe I think that's important to raise.
Awesome. Just on a technical note, I'm going to just go and mute everyone for Charlene and Mary to respond to that. And Miriam, we got like legendary organizers on this call just not revealing themselves.
I know, Miriam was on the call talking about this. Miriam's part of the Chicago Bond Fund's advisory board and has been a huge help and inspiration to us all along. So thank you, Miriam. We're a volunteer run organization. We were all volunteer for the first year and a half. We do have one staff person working for 30 hours a week doing a lot of admin and operations work for us now. And part of the thing is when we post bond for someone, we support them afterwards. And we have volunteers who help check in about their needs and help. We've done everything from provide rides to court or texts or phone call reminders about court to throwing baby showers and doing fundraisers for other sorts of things that people need when they get out. And as their case goes on for sometimes years, that second person that we posted bond for in December of 2015, her case is still ongoing. It's now more than 2 years old. And so it is a challenge. And I think the challenge for us has been to like expanding the number of people doing work and also continuing to do the work with fidelity and commitment. Bringing people in and not being afraid of being let down by folks who are new to this work. That's the challenge, especially when the stakes feel really high, because we want to keep people free. And it's important for us to be a community mutual aid organization and accountable to the grassroots movements in Chicago and not to be limited by funders and not to become a social service organization. So that's a challenge because I think there's a lot of people who could benefit from social services. So what we've done is create partnerships and link up and make referrals when people need more professional kinds of support or help because of the violence of the jail and the violence of poverty and state violence generally, but it has been a challenge. So we've really been trying to collect resources and share them out.
Thank you. And for sure, a particular challenge, not having staff. Mary, I know that y'all are a lean, scrappy, member-driven grassroots organization as well, though with some staff. Do you want to weigh in on this question and jump in on the power of the grassroots volunteer members?
Yeah, so we have a staff of 9 right now, might be getting 10. But I think we, the Mamas Day Action, I think we clocked about 350 or so people who volunteered inside of SONG to make this happen across these different sites. And one of the things that I don't think we were being naive about, but because we knew that, you know, our folks, people coming out, like they're going to need help getting stabilized, yo. And one of the things that I think we had to be honest with ourselves about is like, we're organizers and there are some things we just don't know. And there are some things that some of, you know, our well-intended young organizers just do not know. how, you know, whether that's trying to get support for folks and negotiating, you know, the interpersonal stuff that folks are dealing with once they get out. But our folks were like, we're going to try to hold that. And so one of the things that we were like, okay, how do we best provide support for people? And we had a few social workers step up and like, yo, we're going to totally help and help people navigate, you know, the system, help navigate and help people figure out how to get their ID back and stuff like that. And so one of the reasons why we didn't, as Song didn't really engage deeply in like the Father's Day bailout is because we were like, yo, we're still trying to make sure that the moms we bailed out are stable. And for places like Atlanta, we bailed out 25, and places like Charlotte, it was 6, Durham 14. Like it was just a different amount of capacity and asking. We're asking for people to give. And I think, you know, I think it is a labor of love. And I think it is, you know, us realizing that we don't have all the answers, and people have a lot of heart, a lot of grit, a lot of rigor. And there are just some things that some of our folks are not positioned to be doing. And so we learned a lot around how to better build relationships with folks who have more experience navigating direct services and helping us navigate, you know, all of these systems that our folks have to engage with. But having a membership base of, you know, a lot of, it's intergenerational, but a lot of folks who often show up are young people in their 20s. Our elders will show up when called upon. Yeah, it was a game changer for us, but it also showed us where, as an organization, we need to be building deeper in terms of the relationships with different organizations, that we need to be building deeper, because we're like, we're not direct service. We're not going to pretend that we are. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we're building those relationships and connections so that folks can get that. Because our members were like, what in the world? Oh my gosh, trying to figure it out. But yeah, our folks are ready now. Black August, here we come.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I mean, that also speaks so clearly to the need for us as we build abolition. It's not just about tearing down and dismantling the systems of the prison industrial complex, but it's about building up the systems in our communities that we need in order to thrive and live and survive this crazy world. So and to do that, we need to rely on ourselves and also rely on the networks that we have in place and the knowledge that we have in community already, as well as building up new models and new resources that we haven't seen yet. So with that, I know we're about at the end of our time here, have run a little bit over. I want to offer up a huge thank you first to Mary and Charlene for joining this morning, but even more so for the work that y'all do on the daily and the work that your organizations do as a part of this movement and this struggle. And I just want to kick it to each of you. If there's any last websites or resources, actions to take. Mary, I heard you say Black August, what's coming up? So anything like that, just one last minute from each of you that you want to throw in a quick plug.
Yeah, well, we're going to be embarking on doing some more bailouts, calling for a national bailout for the month of Black August. That has a month of resistance rooted in the struggles of political prisoners. And also just want to be wanting to make those connections around mass incarceration and this issue around ending bail and pretrial incarceration. And so yeah, we'll be jamming out. So more information on that will be coming out soon. And again, check out nomoremoneybail.org. Miriam was also played a major role in the toolkit. So awesome, awesome, awesome. Please check it out. And we'll be, in terms of Song, if you go on our website, there's we just put out a 10 lessons learned from the Mama's Day bailout, as well as some other resources that we've been developing through this process. Again, how to do a bailout, things of that nature. So yeah, and you can hit us up on Facebook and Instagram, all of that. We're Southerners Underground. Ignite Kindred is our handles. That's the word, handles, not it. But yeah, we just appreciate being in relationship with Critical Resistance and all the amazing work that you all have done to give us so much to work with. So appreciate you.
No, thank you. Charlene, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I'll just add thank you, Mary and Miriam and everyone who worked on the Mama's Day bailout, because we've learned from your lessons as well and learned from your example. Yeah, we're available as a resource. Reach out to us. Contact information is on our website, which is chicagobond.org. And the only thing I'll say as a parting word, just since we touched on it, we didn't get to really respond, is if you live in a place where policymakers are talking about forming a bail fund, tell them to get out of here with that, right? If you're in charge of making
change yes.
policy, you don't engage in charity as a policymaker. So it's ridiculous, right. And we know that there'll be all kinds of things supporting that. So I just want to, just because we touched on it, and I know it's something that's coming up in a lot of places. So that's for community. That's not for government. That's all.
Great. Thank you so much for dropping that at the end. It's so important. Really appreciate the two of you for joining and for all of our listeners. And again, as Jess mentioned, we'll be posting this recording. So please share it out with your organizations, your communities, however is most useful for really spreading the word on how we can use bail reform towards abolition. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye, friends.
Bye. Have a good day.